Okay, so today's plan is finishing up with the equilibrium universe. Basically, what we have left is the entropy of the universe, which is pretty important in your homework. And we'll start to talk about how one is CMB generated. I'll start to copy down some formulas that could be useful today without trying to derive it. And that's for some relativistic species. There's nothing subtle there, you just have to do an integral. And then you have the number for them. It's given by a theta function. The number, it is 3. And then there's also the corresponding numbers for bosons and fermions. And let me remind you, it's different because the distribution has the plus minus one in the denominator. And this is for non-relativist particles. We have this. And it has a polynomial factor. But most importantly, it has this exponential suppress, says the heavier particle you are, the universe hits you more. And if it's in equilibrium, then there's no mass density. Okay, so what are we going to do is to do something called the tally up numbers. So what it's doing says now let's sum over all the radiation and wonder what's the radiation density. Because as we go backwards in the universe becomes hotter and hotter. Some things that are non-relativistic become relativistic. It's all relatively true. If you heat the universe hot enough at the very, not the very beginning, but to like 10 to the minus 12 second, everything particle we know are considered to be massless because the universe is really hot. So that's why the radiation density needs to actually take into account the possibility that that's the case. So it's always written in a very interesting way. So basically, instead of depend on g, which for photon it's 2 degrees of photon freedom, it's just how many degrees of freedom a photon has. But for this, they still want to write it in one formula and hides everything crazy in this thing. Says that it's for all the boson, we do a summation, says it's boson and the T boson of to the fourth plus all the fermion and the GI TI over T to the fourth. And this one multiplies by 7/8. So it looks crazy, but if you take all the TI equals T, which is the photon temperature, it basically means we have many differences of species, and you really, it's just a sum of rho. So this thing is really just sum of rho r written in a very weird way because, as you will discover in your homework, that the relativistic species and some other relativistic species might not be at the same temperature. Yeah.
Sorry, what are the GI?
They suggest the degrees of freedom. So you have like like a photon, so it's 2. Then if you have an electron, the universe is hotter than hotter than electron, then it considered to be radiation two, then it's another two. It's like electron is two spins, positron has another two spins. It's just degrees of freedom. Whatever that you count all the species, you look at all the species of the particles could be considered to be massless at that moment, and you count all their degrees of freedom, and you tally them up, you get this G star number. And this is taking into account that sometimes this different species might already decoupled from large thermal bath. They might have a different temperature. So that's it's like a converted degrees of freedom, taking into account the fact that because, okay, so if let's just consider photons and the neutrinos, because then we have both bosons and the fermions, and we have the temperature issue. As you will discover in your homework, neutrinos is slightly cooler than the photons. That happens at electron-positron annihilation. So that you will discover in the homework. So then if I say this is rho photon plus rho neutrino, then of course I use that formula. Okay. Equals, of course, this thing is always there, but then I have a G photon times T to the fourth, so that's just that formula. But for neutrino, which is fermion, I have to use the prefactor of a 7/8, and the G neutrino times T neutrino to the fourth. So that's how normally, that's what we should do. This is the density of the photon, density of the neutrino. But they like to, people like to express the summation of all the radiation. To write it in this way, then they can just look at this throughout of the universe. And it says that the radiation density is still proportional to T the fourth, except that this G star will change as universe cools. So if you take the T to the four out, and of course you pick up this vector. It's just you, if you are determined to write it in this form, then you put everything in the middle, then it will look like that. But what you do is really, there's one species, and you add another species contribution, and the dali dali dala. And this, after standard model, you can do a very careful count from back when you know everything's massless, how many degrees freedom we have, and whenever there is a transition, something becomes massive, then there's some other number. It basically just steadily going down whenever something, you know, become massive and become non-relativistic, then we don't count them, and it just goes down like this. It's a G star of a T plot. So let's see, no, this is basically time. So this when temperature is really low, like now, maybe only photon is radiation, who knows how massive neutrinos are. But if you go back, then electron, if you go back in time, the universe is hot enough for electrons' rest mass to be small compared to the temperature of the universe, then electrons become relativistic. So each time this thing, like there's pions, they could be, you could be have a temperature higher than pion and a temperature higher than proton. And if you just going back, you get something like this. And you can look at the precise one on the lecture notes.
These only count the relativistic degrees of freedom.
This only counts because we're only calculating the radiation density.
So just so I'm clear, so when something becomes massive, it stops counting, and that's why you can step.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
So this is only counting the relativistic degrees of freedom, and we'll say why. why that we only count the relativistic degrees of freedom. Actually, we're going to say why right now. So the point is the next thing we're going to talk about after tallying numbers, as I say, it's written in a very weird way, but it's nothing mysterious. You just take every single thing that is relativistic, use this formula, add them all up. And if you insist your formula still look like this, then you have this thing in the middle. And you're like, why would I do that? Why would I worry about this? And in particular, why I don't worry about the non-relativistic degrees of freedom? Well, of course, if we want to calculate the radiation density, we of course only worry about the radiation degrees of freedom. But what else is this thing good for? You can just either, you know, have a list of standard model particles to start counting, or you can just open a book that contains this plot and then read it off. But why do I need this thing? So it comes from that we need to discuss about the entropy of the universe. So we'll come back to the topic why this J star is useful for us. So this is a very important thing, is that basically you already know, we secretly already do that, is remember at the beginning we argue that it's a homogeneous universe. There must be no heat flow. So we have a nicer first law of thermodynamics and just set it to be zero. And of course, according to this argument, you can just look that you say, oh, okay, entropy is conserved. That's also basically our assumption that the universe is in this local equilibrium. You can, of course, just take this whole thing to do ddt to calculate, because this is how we normally define it's conserved. You can show that this basically, the right-hand side of this will have the continuity equation, which is not a surprise. That's how we derive it. But the continuity equation also just come from Einstein equations and B and K and ddt. So you can you go the other way, says I can find the continuity equation somewhere else and use that to prove the entropy of the universe is conserved. So this is an important thing to keep in mind when it's in thermal equilibrium. And you argue the entropy produced when the universe goes out of equilibrium is always small compared to what the equilibrium entropy. So we're just going to say that it's almost always conserved. Yeah?
Does this mean that the expansion of the universe is reversible if ds is zero? So.
Well. Then it would be a great question if you ask Angelica when she talks about a bouncing universe, right? If you talk about a bouncing universe, that must be having the assumption. Well, from the Friedman equation, as we look at the solutions, that they are the re-collapsing. We're not re-collapsing because of dark energy. So I would say so. Yes, you could have an evolution of the universe that is reversible. We're just not living in one of them. Okay, so the interesting thing that, okay, there is one formula I'm going to state it without deriving, is this thing. So this you can just take, remember the rho equals to E F dP formula, and then you have a formula for P, which is P squared over 3E. And it's an interesting calculus exercise to show that this is true. So. Yeah, but I don't think it's interesting to watch me show you. So we'll just state it and use it to look at a very interesting thing, which is now I'm going to take a look at what is DS. I know it's zero, but let's see. Something more interesting might happen if we have that formula. So I can add a term and a subtract a term. It's a standard strategy of doing things. And thus the U is just D rho V, and this is just DPV, that's just the distribution law. And then this will write another line to combine them because of that particular formula that I introduced. So this is those two terms, and that term I'm going to use that guy. It says dp, I can express dp as p plus rho divided by t times dt. And if you stare at it for a long time, you realize you can actually combine them all in the total derivative. And of course, we started with a total derivative. It's not a huge surprise we end up with total derivative. But now we get something cute. It says the entropy is equals to this thing times V. Well, which means we can define something called the entropy density, which is given by rho plus p over t. And then, okay, now I have to make an argument. It's a good position to make an argument. Says that the entropy is basically all contributed by radiation. There's just so much photons than baryon in our universe. Actually, that's the main result of this afternoon's tutorial, is that it's only when we assume we have a billion photon versus one baryon that we can post-dict that we have 25% helium. It's a very interesting result that, later on, WMAP managed to measure this thing called standard notation, and eta is defined to be the baryon photon ratio and happen to be 10 to the minus 9 with some prefactors, some order one number here. So it's crazy. There's just like so many photons. So it really doesn't matter, those massive particles, they contribute a really minute amount of entropy. Entropy is something like a very democratic. It's like a voting. And the photons just way overwhelm the baryons. So that formula, I can immediately use the equation of state, says it's just that. And here is, I have to look at that formula because how could I remember that thing? But the result is 2 over 45. And of course, the next thing I do, don't be too surprised, is to tally up the numbers. So this is one species, depends on which species I am. But now I can sum them all together. And again, it's always written in that crazy fashion that there is something in the middle. And this thing in the middle is called the entropy contributing relativistic number. And compared to that crazy formula, it's just changed the 4 to 3. So it's, let me just write it out. There's bosons, and there's bosons GI, and TI over T to the 3. And it's just that annoying because the sometimes they are not at the same temperature. So this thing, but the important thing is, remember this is called the entropy density. And we know entropy density, entropy itself is conserved, which means I can put the volume back, says this is a constant. That's what we mean by entropy is conserved. Then of course we will have T is proportional to N inverse, but now there is an important correction. So T is proportional to A inverse is not taking into account that the standard model happened to have so many different kinds of particles. And if we take that into account, then T is basically proportional to A inverse if we are on this one of these plateaus when there's no particles suddenly become non-relativistic and go away. But if that happens, when you are change, then the temperature, because as universe expands, this number is, the universe is cooling, so the relativistic particles are dropping. When you are stepping down west of the stairs, the J to the whatever inverse is going to go up. So it will be, so one universe will be, say, the temperature will drop slightly slower than A inverse. So as we try to explain, it's when the universe expands, it's going to cool, it's A inverse, but actually it's not precisely like that. Whenever this thing happens, then you will drop slightly slower. And the physical explanations is whenever these things happens, that the things, we lose some radiation degree of freedom, they become non-relativistic. For example, you're going to start study in homework two is when electron positron annihilate. So when they annihilate, they will dump some energy. The annihilation, they become pure energy. And those pure energy gets dumped into the thermal bus. So they heat it up the thermal bus a little bit. So that's the intuition explanation where this factor comes from. And you're going to precisely study this, study this in your homework about this factor, and you predict, okay, post-dict, what's the temperature for the cosmic neutrino background? You think about it, they dump to the thermal bus, okay, there are a bunch of photons, they thermalize again, so it's still a black body spectrum, but the neutrino is long decoupled. They didn't get any of this energy. So according to this formula, the neutrino should be slightly cooler. How to catch those neutrinos is completely another matter. I don't know how to catch them. I mean, they are very hard to catch. But the people are trying to collect evidence why, how the neutrino, how the predicted cosmic neutrino background could be detected. Okay, so that's why this thing is important. And that's why if you graph G star S, it's basically the same, but because this T to the power 4 and T to the power 3, and because neutrino indeed have a different temperature, so if you look at those two curves at the very end after neutrino had a different temperature, then it's there is the G star S line is slightly lower than that. Yeah.
Because G star has some temperature.
Yep.
Does that not, like, is that, does that not affect this? Like, I mean, you've temperature dependence on both sides of this proportionality, right?
Yep. But that one is just a step function. Like, it's not like a power law that I didn't take care of. It's just that basically the idea of T proportion to 1 over A applies for each of those Platos. And the question is that how does this Plato compare to when interesting things happen, when things start decouple, get out of a non-thermal equilibrium in the universe? So yes, what this is saying is that, so it's written in a way that it has temperature dependence, but if you look at the plot when people calculate this, it's really a bunch of a step function until the end, but it's still a step function. It's like it's the one this the non-relativistic, the things become non-relativistic and then freeze out. Remember this curve we draw yesterday says you can become, you if you are still in the equilibrium, you're like this. But at some point, the gamma is of order h, and then you just freeze out. So this is the n times a cube. So this basically only change when this happens, and this happens pretty abruptly. It's not like a gradual process. It's really that this is a certain number, 103.325, whatever. And then at a very brief moment of history, and then it's changed to 98, something like that.
The TIs.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is that it's only at the very end that TI is actually different from T. So we really just, we really only just know that T nu is related to T gamma by some factor, that something like 11 over 4 to the third. Don't count me on that. That's in the homework.
But basically for every other source of radiation, it's the same as the universe
right.
temperature.
Right. That because if you look at the plot of G star and G star S on top of each other, it's the same curve until at the very end. So only at the very end, G star and G star S deviates. So before then means everything is at the same temperature as the universe. So you are either radiation and thermalized with the photon, or you are non-relativistic and get it kicked out. And the neutrino is the exception that they could be kicked out because the weak interaction is just weak, but they are still radiation. So those two plots different is because of the neutrino. I think that it will be clear after you do the homework to realize how neutrino become at a different temperature from the photon. And that just doesn't happen for all the other particles. They just become non-relativistic, Because as long as you become non-relativistic, nobody cares about you. Because the voting thing, that it's just 10 to the 9 is a hard, is a high number to beat. And, the non-relativistic particles also, then the entropy only counts the relativistic particle. And there is the exception, which is neutrino, is they can decouple and they remain in the radiation, so they have an impact. Somehow they get lower temperature due to the electron-positron annihilation, and then they will have an impact on this factor.
Okay.
So about this number, so this number is basically, it's a crazy number. And basically, the people's, it's basically related to the matter-antimatter thing, that you would think, you know, you will have protons around and make us, there should also be antiprotons around, but it's good that they are not around us, but they should. There's no reason that they shouldn't. So this is called the asymmetry, that why we only, so the thing is the people look in the universe. There's no big number of antibaryons. And they would expect this number to be similar, but it turned out it seems that at some very early point of universe, at about 1 GeV, then we have a bunch of baryons, and we have a bunch of antibaryons. This bunch is 10 to the 9, and there is 10 to the 9 minus 1. Antibaryon, they annihilate, hey, baryon win, and then the one stays and, you know, form the whole galaxy and the stars and us and the stuff. And this is a very interesting problem, and Latham is an expert on this. And he has lots of ideas about the baryon genesis, which that's what's it called. They don't know how this is generated. Let's say how little we know about this issue is that there is this guy called Sakhanov. Basically, what we know so far is that he says there are three principles we need to follow to solve this problem. First of all, baryon number needs to be violated, which you might have heard that the standard model doesn't violate the baryon number. But this is, of course, if you don't violate the baryon number, you would never generate a baryon asymmetry. Otherwise, you know, you can assume that we have a crazy initial condition, and somehow they are just different by a billion. So then, second is we need the CP violation. So otherwise, it's a standard model thing, but it basically says the particle and the antiparticle behave differently. And we need it because, you know, you happen to generate some excess baryons, but if you have CP symmetry, then the process will be canceled out by the things generated antibaryons. And this you will explore. You will certainly explore CP violation very carefully in standard model. Standard model does have some CP violation, but people think it's not enough. So we need some extra source. And the other one is that the universe needs to be out of equilibrium. If everything is thermalized, this asymmetry you generate is probably going to go back by the reverse action. But we know things go out of equilibrium. We're going to study those epoch today. But that's so far what we know about the baryon genesis. Those three conditions need to be satisfied. And that's the end of story. But Latham has lots of interesting things to say about baryon genesis. And I believe the CPT universe they proposed recently has something to do with this, which we'll explore in the last homework. Okay. Yeah.
What makes you like become non-relativistic at some point or another is just your mass?
It's just your mass. That's it's really just compare temperature with the mass.
Kinetic energy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I think that's, there's some comments about a chemical potential which shows up in that formula, but there's only, Okay, there's three comments. First of all, if you have such a reaction, then chemical equilibrium requires that the chemical potentials should be equal to each other. Just like the left-hand side chemical potential sum up would be equal to the right-hand side. This is called an equilibrium condition. And the second of all, if you, oh, this one we can see a little deeper about it. This is one of our favorite interactions. And the QED says that the electron gamma can scatter into electron gamma. But you know, if you shoot off another gamma, it's allowed. And photon is massless, so making photon actually doesn't cost you anything. So chemical potential of photon is zero. And the last thing is that you can show that we basically take in the early universe that the electron and the neutrinos does not have chemical potential. And that's all I want to say about a chemical potential. So now we'll close this chapter, and now we're going to apply the tools to CMB. Okay? New chapter. There are some tools, and we're going to use all of them, and we're going to use them all of them again this afternoon. Just to make sure everybody knows what kind of approximations like we are using and how that they actually can yield some nice results without going through all the Boltzmann equation things. Just study the equilibrium, the free result. And then we make some predictions. Okay, CMB. So we start this entire course. Do you guys remember where do we start? We start to ask a question. Wait, I can actually observe cosmology just by going home at night. And I realize the night is dark. And that's a very important observation. It already tells us, oh, the universe is probably have a finite age. Well, you know, it's good to keep an open mind. So if you imagine there are some other species also observe the universe, and they have their eyes sensitive to millimeter light rather than the visible light defined by our eyes, they will have a completely different opinion. They wouldn't say there's a difference. They wouldn't define day and night because they would be like, oh, no, our sky is completely uniform. Unless their eyes are sensitive to 10 to the minus 5 difference. But in principle, they say, no, our sky is completely uniform at a temperature of 2.725 Kelvin. And we're going to investigate on that. So how does that happen? So you remember the interesting experiment, you know, they have to clean out pigeons and stuff, that actually it's very interesting. If you think about the 2.725 Kelvin, they find out, you know, it's probably 10 to the minus 4 eV or 5 or 6, a typical photon like that. This kind of, it's really small amount of energy, definitely wouldn't ionize like hydrogens or any, you know, any atom. But it's very interesting enough, it's precisely of the energy that will excite a water molecule. So you know, water molecule can vibrate, can oscillate. This energy is precisely at the energy of a typical CMB photon today. So if we actually build a telescope on Earth trying to observe CMB, we might not discover it because they are all absorbed by the water molecule in the atmosphere. That's why whenever you hear about CMB, it's all about the balloons. There is a very famous balloon called Boomerang. It's a balloon. And I carry some equipment trying to measure CMB. And then, of course, then you heard about the satellite, the WMAP, and there's Planck. And the first one is COBE. And that's the reason. It's because you can't do terrestrial experiment on CMB. They will, like you have a black body peak, and where the peak is will all be absorbed by the water molecule. You wouldn't see this beautiful curve of Planck distribution. And what Pearson and Wilson success, they are not cosmologists. They are trying, well, they might become. But by then, they are astrophysics trying to find a radio wave that where they're interested. So they're looking at something like really at the tail of the black hole. It's like they're really at a centimeter, seven centimeters, like 40 times away from the center. So it's really quite an accident. Anyway, but then COBE satellite is sent to the sky, and they bring back three results. Is that in every direction, it's a black body. It's the best black body we have ever discovered. And this temperature is at 2.725. And if you look really carefully, there is this square. And the root, it's the mean square root thing that this is about 10 to the minus 5. It's extremely uniform. Barbara has this really nice analogy, says if our Earth is as uniform as CMB, then the tallest mountain and the lowest trough would be separated by 7 meters. That's how uniform this thing is. So, well, our today's job is trying to figure out how and when it's produced. So basically, you know, to produce some photons travel through the entire universe and into our satellite or some equipment, we need a transparent universe. They need to be free streaming. If they just get bounced, you know, along the way, it wouldn't look so black body. So we need the universe to go from opaque to transparent. And the photon needs to decouple. So the reason that the photon ever wants to decouple, well, photon, as I draw this Feynman diagram, says they like to scatter with electrons. The only reason that a photon would ever try to decouple is that, no, it tried to interact with other things, they're not there. All the electrons are combined into hydrogen, no free electron. Hence, the photon has no partner to scatter, means that we get a transparent universe. So in order to have a CMB to observe today, in the history of the universe, what we need to study is the recombination era, which is just combination, but everybody says it's a recombination. So what is happening here is I have an electron and I have a proton, they form hydrogen. And when the electrons are all combined into hydrogen, photon can't scatter. They just travel freely to us. So that's basically the idea. So then we try to say, you know, the hydrogen energy, well, I still remember this number because I, you know, use it so many times in the hydrogen atom when I study quantum mechanics. But this is the ionization energy of hydrogen. So basically, you want the universe to be cooler than that. If it's hotter than that, the reverse reaction just go. The hydrogen you form, then they become ionized, okay. If the photons are busy ionizing hydrogen, they're not gonna travel free to us. So let's do a rough estimate. So if we want a typical photon wants to reach this energy, the typical photon is something like a 2 times 70. So for a black body, and you take the peak and look at how much energy they get, it's about that. Let's just say it's a 3. So basically, you want the temperature. This gave's temperature is about 5 eV, give or take. Yeah, not too bad, divided by 3. It's okay, this. And actually, that didn't happen. And when the universe is at 5 eV, no hydrogen is combined.
Sorry, why do you need the temperature to be 5 eV?
So if the temperature is 5, then a typical photon would have 3 times that much energy. So it's just this. If you draw the temperature at T, and then you take a photon at the peak, and you look at how much energy they have, it's about a 3T. It's, you can see, yeah, if you say, suppose you, we think, so like, you know PV equals nRT, so that's N times KBT, and you know rho is equals to 3P, so basically that sort of tell you that an average photon has about a 3T. That's another way to look at it. So that's just, let's write a photon at T has energy about 3T. It's just the mean of the black body spectrum. So if you imagine we want a typical photon to ionize the hydrogen, then you would expect the temperature needs to be 5 eV also. But that didn't happen. Why 5 eV is not good enough? Like actually, what happens is there's some hydrogen produced, but they are immediately ionized. There's no item. It's still a soup of electrons and the protons and the photons. Ah, see, this number is very important. We have lots of photons. A hell lot of photons. That number is so huge that we can't take a typical photon. Think about it, around every single hydrogen atom that's formed, there's a billion photons zipping through trying to ionize it. And if you look at the spectrum, you can go quite far to the end and with a still find. So basically it says that I need to find a photon that is at 13.6 eV. But actually, you don't need to be typical photon, you just need some photon because the huge amount of photon. So that brings this number significantly down. And which means we can't estimate, so we actually have to calculate. Yeah? But the logic is clear. If you have like 1 billion photons, then the typical photon doesn't have to have 13.6 eV. Out of this 1 billion photon, we just need like one that being able to ionize the hydrogen so that the hydrogen wouldn't form. So now we are actually calculate when does it form. Yeah.
How do you, all these photons we get from CMB, they're redshifted, right?
Yeah.
So how do you determine the actual like temperature they have? Like as a black body, because you don't know when they're
just all black body, you just go back in the universe.
Well, but we don't know when.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to determine.
But can you do it like separately?
No.
Because you first say they need to decouple and then, right, okay.
So we are trying to determine when that happens. Okay. So we don't know. Yes, we do not know the number. The first estimate is completely off.
Okay.
We are trying to now do a serious calculation. Mm-hmm. Well, sort of, because we're not solving Boltzmann equation.
Wait, this number, you say 2.3 the t, is that accounting for the redshift, or that's what we see from the shifted red body, black body?
No, 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 that's at the time. So this t, so at our CMB, it's always 2.735,
okay,
right?
Right.
So at some earlier time, it's a different temperature. You pick a typical photon, it's 3t.
Okay, right.
But this is completely off.
Great.
Great, it's completely off. Otherwise, what am I going to do now, right? Okay, so now actually let's do some serious study. And write, so basically they are in thermal equilibrium. That's what we try to argue, is that before this recombination starts, everything is in thermal equilibrium. Which means we have all these beautiful things captured by this formula. So since they are all in thermal equilibrium, then they are all governed by this formula. Right? So now, the idea is we don't really know what's the proton's chemical potential and what's the hydrogen's chemical potential, but we're just going to be smart about it and study this combination and using our thermal equilibrium condition to cancel it out. So that's a very interesting step. Is that we'll find something to study such that has no thermal chemical potential in it. Otherwise, we have things we don't know about, and I don't want to get into. Sorry, let's say baryons. But all the baryons are protons, basically. Whether, as you will show this, as you will see that the 25% helium means that you have about 10% in number in helium. We're just going to ignore it. We're just going for an all-proton universe. We're not going to be off by that much because of that. So this, I'm just basically copying down that formula down, but the various of things drop off. And that's another 3/2. And there's a t to the 2 pi on top twice and on bottom once. So there's like one effect of that. And what is important is this factor comes up. So each term, hopefully is right. And that's what it is. And we know what's this number. That's the 13.6 eV. That's the binding energy for hydrogen, which is 13.6 eV. Okay. Let me just check so that I don't do. Yep. Okay, we're going to do some nice things. That there is two states of electron, two states of proton. Hydrogen happens to have four states, one singlet, one triplet. This you can just look it up. This you just know, so that it disappear. And this also disappear because proton and hydrogen is basically the same mass because there's an exponential. So the power law things, you can just do all sorts of estimate, right? Okay, and there's temperature, there's nothing I can do about it. That is the minus binding energy because the thing that made into hydrogen is at a higher energy. Okay, so what do we have now? Now we're going to define.
Sorry.
Yeah.
How do you know the proton and electron have 2 degrees of freedom?
It's just the spin.
Oh, spin. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And okay, so after we do all this, let's see what do we have left. What do we have left? Is some ME to the 3/2. Let's combine the ME and the T term to the 3/2. And this is minus binding energy over T. Okay, so what we're going to do, it's just a typical thing people do, is that they say, they define this thing called X. It measures the fraction that has been ionized. So there's a free electron, and this basically includes the free proton, the proton that already is in the hydrogen. So this is a measure of how ionized our universe is. Yeah? So we're going to try to expand that in terms of this. So we have NE is X times N baryon. And the free proton is also NX times N baryon. Because the free proton, the free electron, they are the same. And NH, on the other hand, is the rest of the baryon. So it must be 1 minus X N baryon. So that's just what the left-hand side is. It is captured in this ionization factor, and we have this N baryon. So I did something different from when I did it yesterday. So let me fix this. It's just I'm going to invert the whole thing. So what? Sorry. I'm sorry to cause confusion, but I'm going to invert the whole thing, which is what happens over here is this to the 3/2 and e to the b h over t, which this is 13.6 eV. And now we're going to do a thing called making use of the baryon to photon density, which is eta times n photon, because we always know how many photons there are. It's given by that formula. N photon is always given than that because we have perfect black body thing, which is 2 zeta 3. Don't worry about these too much. I'm just copying a number from over there. Pi squared and T cubed. So this is the photon density. What happened is the multiplying the baryon density on the right, and then use the baryon to photon ratio to express it as a photon density, which we know exactly what it is. And then you know you have all this other stuff. I can absorb a T over here. But what you have is here. So hey, so see, now we see the problem. The problem is we have a 10 to the minus 9 here. So basically, an ionization fraction is say you pick, it's pretty arbitrary. You say if X equals 0.1 means you know only 10% of the electron is still free 10% of the electron is still free, so 90% of them has captured by hydrogen. I'll say that's recombination error. But it's pretty arbitrary. You pick an arbitrary x, but on this hand side, this exponential thing, as t goes down, this exponential thing has to compete with this fixed number 10 to the minus 9. So that's why a typical photon is not going to be good enough. You need like t to be dropped significantly so that this number is huge to be able to cancel that out that the baryon photon ratio. So that's, but which exactly what we discussed is that if you have a lot of photons, they really like to ionize hydrogen. So that is precisely captured in this calculation. So if you plug this number, you have to solve this equation, 0.3. So that's, you know, a factor of 10-ish from our naive calculation. And curiously, if you take a log of 10 to the minus 9, you get a 20. So basically captured by this number. You say, I take a log of this and I want this to be able to compete. To be able to compete with this number, that's why you want a much, much smaller temperature than the naive expectation. So, well, I guess I'll stop here.